Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 75 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling a few of my favorite podcasts. Don't ask me why, but when it comes to significant milestones, 75 is the one I pick. Called the Diamond Jubilee when measured in years, Wheat All About It can't claim that distinction, but I think the 75 podcasts I've posted so far deserve recognition. Most Wheat All About It episodes have a long shelf life, and I recommend listeners who only recently joined us to sample earlier efforts. It's a bit more difficult to access historical episodes, as iTunes only keeps the 15 or so most recent. You can, however, find all the podcasts through the WGC website at wagrains.org. Go to the bottom of the page, click on Summaries, find the podcast you want, and listen or download directly from there. Please help ensure Wheat All About It continues. Get out there and convince your family, friends, neighbors, landlords, and agribusiness contacts that this Washington Grain Commission podcast deserves to be heard. And for those of you who subscribe on iTunes, please rate the podcast on the 1-5 star ranking. Although many of the podcasts on my top 10 list are also among the top 10 most listened to, that's not the case for all. Interestingly, as I was making my selection, I found I had different reasons for liking each one, sort of like how you love your children, the same but different. I hope these snippets of my favorite podcasts will cause a few of you to go back and listen to the whole episode. Not only will you become better informed, you'll hear my evolution as a podcaster. My podcast with Jay Penner, episode 16, entitled Pay Attention, is number one on my top 10 list. Penner spoke to me from a hospital bed where he was learning to deal with his new reality. A fall from his tractor while removing a GPS antenna paralyzed his body from the nipples down, a medical description that refers to the loss of lower body movement. I was so grateful when Penner agreed to talk with me. At the time I recorded him, he was in Spokane at a rehabilitation hospital. He's now back on his ranch in Columbia County, continuing to mend. At one point during the interview, I ask him what he would have done differently if he'd had the chance.
I would have went about a different way of taking that GPS antenna down off of there, I can tell you that. I'd have had a ladder that I could have crawled up and crawled back down. Even though it wasn't that high off the ground, safety is something that you should have in your mind 24 hours a day.
And at that particular moment, you didn't have safety in mind?
I did not have safety in my mind. I was early in the morning, I had things I wanted to do, so I just bowled right through it, and it got me.
And what is the advice that you might give to the other farmers and the rest of us out there, something to learn from what has happened to you?
Well, I think you better have that heart-to-heart talk with your people saying, hey, you know, I want you to be a lot safer than what you've been, and this can happen to you just as well as it happened to him. And go down to Walmart and buy you a 10-foot ladder and carry it with you.
Penner's comments about safety being something farmers should have in their minds 24 hours a day has stayed with me. All these months later, I remember our conversation as I moved through the day. As one of Wheat All About It's most popular episodes, I'd like to think that Penner, through sharing his story, has saved a few people from their own traumatic injuries. Number two on my top 10 list is episode 8, about one of the biggest challenges facing Pacific Northwest wheat farmers, low soil pH. In the podcast, I interview three experts in the field, including Elston Solberg, a Canadian soil scientist. It's one of my favorite podcasts because it addresses a significant problem Pacific Northwest farmers need to know more about. Even though, as Solberg comments here, it's not exactly new information.
Oh, you've got some of the best lime experts on the planet in the U.S. They're just all in the Midwest and the Mid-South. They lime their fields like they put on their shorts every day. So it's not like the U.S. doesn't know what they're talking about. It's not like Canada doesn't know what they're talking about. Ontario, Quebec, the eastern provinces, they've started with acid soils. They know how to lime soils. It's just something, I don't know where you hit it. Something happens at the 40th meridian, and it's just like a lime force field or something.
A lime force field at the 40th meridian is a nice turn of phrase, and one Pacific Northwest farmers should take note of. According to the experts, farmers who have soil pH problems in their field may be wasting as much as 50% of the nitrogen they apply. Not only that, but liming is beneficial against Cephalosporium stripe in acidic soils. It's fun to rediscover earlier podcasts, but just to be clear, I also have favorites among my more recent offerings. Coming in at number 3 is episode 72, Spring Seeding with the WGC's Mike Karstensen. It was great fun interviewing one of the newest commission members from the cab of his quad-track tractor as he planted soft white spring wheat. Not to mention, his answers to my questions articulated a farmer's worldview that deserves attention. Here, Karstensen answers my question whether the years from 2008 to 2013 allowed farmers to get healed up.
Anytime you double the value of a commodity that you raise, you just doubled your gross income. And so if you're smart about it and you didn't overspend, most guys got healed up. They should have got healed up, and they probably socked away some for a rainy day. I don't know if we'll ever have another super commodity cycle like that again. I don't know if I'll see one. I'm glad my father got to see it when he was here. And I guess if you look at history, you have to go back to the early 1900s, I guess, when it was many, many years ago they had a super cycle in grains. I'm glad my father got to see one. I'm hoping I get to see another one, but I don't know if we ever will have that again.
I came aboard the Washington Grain Commission in 2008, and for the next several years, I read pundits who suggested the rules of the game had changed and that the cyclic pattern of agriculture's ups and downs were in the past. I didn't believe it, but like farmers, I sure enjoyed the ride while it lasted. Number 4 on my top 10 list is also of more recent vintage, episode 67 entitled Lima Grain Shakes Things Up. I liked it not only for what it tells listeners about how varieties are now being marketed, I liked it for how it came together with a trio of Lima Grain executives being interviewed over the course of several months. Interviews with Jim Peterson, Lima Grain's vice president for research, bookend the episode. I've known Peterson for more than 25 years. A wheat breeder when I first met him, he's like me, another old dog who has learned new tricks. Here he explains what working with a bunch of marketers has taught him.
First of all, I've learned a lot from these guys about marketing since I joined Lima Grain in 2010. You still have to have a solid package of genetics. You still have to have a solid package of disease resistances. But it's really clear you also have to have a message. You have to have a catchy name. You have to have the visuals. You have to have, you can't overcomplicate it. And I find a lot of my colleagues will do just that. They'll run down a list of traits and a list of disease resistances and susceptibilities, and the grower's eyes glazes over because it's too much. He doesn't understand what is it going to replace, what is he going to remember, what are the two or three key messages that are going to lead him to that variety. So you still have to have a solid product, or you're going to lose it in the marketplace very quickly. But you can increase the penetration, the adoption of a variety very quickly with the right message, with the right background. And again, that marketing information is really critical to us. It's been super.
Peterson's right. The world is a complex place. And if a company can find a message to cut through the clutter, it'll come out ahead. And as long as farmers also come out ahead, I'm okay with that. Coming in at number 5 of my favorite podcast list is episode 53, Meet Derek Sandison, Policy Wonk, which is a recording of a presentation the director of the Washington State Department of Agriculture gave during the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention in Spokane in November 2017. Sandison actually spoke as part of a panel discussion with representatives of Oregon and Idaho's agriculture departments as well. Through the magic of editing, however, I put together a podcast featuring Sandison's answers alone. Here, he responds to a question about how the Farm Bill matters to Washington in good years and bad.
The Farm Bill does provide a framework for a support framework for U.S. agriculture, but it also, more importantly, I think, provides a framework for support of healthy rural communities, and rural communities are the backbone of the ag world. And many of the programs that are in the Farm Bill are, in fact, extremely important to those rural communities. And we're Washington's approach in terms of identifying priorities. I mean, rural broadband and issues like that are going to be very featured. Will be well featured in our priorities that we provide to Congress and our delegation. Obviously, crop insurance extremely important in terms of we went through a bad experience with that in 2016 related to the falling numbers. But you know, bad years, yeah, it's a very important tool. But again, I think we're not going to be a broken record on trade promotion, but that's something that's extraordinarily important in good and bad years. So.
Sandison's episode 53 podcast didn't get a lot of listens, but you've got time. He's a smart guy who really lays it on the line when it comes to challenges facing the wheat industry specifically and agriculture in general. Number 6 on my list is episode 40, the podcast I did with Tim McGreevy, CEO of the USA Dry Pea and Lentil Association, entitled Not Just Wheat Country Anymore. With protein sources ascendant in diets, he believes that pulses will make big inroads into the summer fallow wheat growing areas of the state.
I believe, Scott, that winter peas will transform really eastern Washington agriculture when they really hit their stride. And we have a very aggressive breeding program right now in Pullman that has some terrific commercial grade winter peas that are really ready to go. And the benefit is in those low rainfall areas under direct seed technology where they're conserving their moisture anyway, they get those rains in the winter. And it doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily walk away from summer fallow, but it'll be like a 3-year rotation. You know, they'll have winter wheat, they'll have a pulse crop that they'll raise in the wintertime, and then maybe they'll set some of their land idle for that following wheat crop the next year. That's what folks are doing right now. But it's been profitable. The yields have been terrific in these dryland areas, you know, from, you know, 10 to 12 inch rainfall. You know, what we consider a desert here on the Palouse in Moscow where we're sitting is, where we get, you know, between 22 and 24 inches of rain. Those areas are having yields of, you know, 2,500 pounds, 3,000 pounds an acre. Well, that is a pretty terrific yield compared to, you know, what they're getting on their winter wheat, say for a year like this where they did pretty good. So it's comparable, and the profitability is comparable. And it's a great weed and disease break for that winter wheat and helps with their soil health and reduce their nitrogen input costs the following year. So before I retire, we will see winter peas in eastern Washington in these dryland summer fallow areas. You know, there's 1,000,004 acres of summer fallow in eastern Washington right now, and we figure that we can get at least between 600,000 to 800,000 acres of that would be good for winter pulses.
If McGreevy's right about the potential penetration of pulses, well, I don't need to tell farmers what a change that would represent. But every generation changes, and they do it either because market or agronomic conditions dictate it. The next few years should be interesting ones in wheat country. At lucky number 7 on my list is the well-named episode 60, Here Today, Japan Tomorrow. You may not have noticed, but I usually try to be creative with my episode names, and I particularly like the title of this one because of the association with Here Today, Gone Tomorrow. I also like this episode because it was the first time the WGC has used the podcast medium as an early warning system to the industry. Although the podcast is about how the U.S. absence from the Trans-Pacific Partnership will affect U.S. wheat farmers, this snippet explains why the Japanese market is so important to the U.S. wheat industry. Over the long haul, Japan has been the most important, purchasing significantly more U.S. wheat than any other country in the world since 1949. For farmers in the Pacific Northwest, Japan holds a special place for its consistent support of soft white wheat production. It is no exaggeration to say that while Oregon farmers pioneered the Japanese market, it was the Japanese themselves who pioneered our soft white wheat exports to the rest of the Pacific Rim. Over the last 60 years, hundreds of teams of Americans and Japanese have crisscrossed the Pacific Ocean to ensure the relationship between us would never grow stale. Other Japanese companies, seeing the strength of the relationship wheat had built, piggybacked on our success, buying or building grain facilities that not only serviced their own country, but many other countries as well. So it is with a lot of anxiety and a little irritation that I tell you we are on a glide path toward losing a substantial portion of the Japanese market. White wheat exports will be impacted severely along with dark northern spring exports, with hard red winter wheat exports potentially taking the biggest hit. For the record, we remain on the same glide path that I talked about when the podcast was released last February. Although President Trump is equivocated with regard to the U.S. re-entering the TPP, his last statement indicated the treaty was a non-starter. At number 8 on my list of favorite podcasts is Episode 46, Drew Lyon, Extension Weed Specialist at WSU, talking about herbicide resistance, or what I called the challenge that will not wait. I find the process through which weeds develop resistance to chemicals fascinating. But it's a challenge Lyon believes some farmers are fighting with one arm tied behind their backs. Here, he responds to my asking whether no-till farming, meaning one pass over the field, is viable in the long run.
I have my doubts that it can happen as currently identified because I think, again, herbicide resistance will eventually win out. I don't think we're going to be producing enough new herbicides to keep us from developing resistance and making herbicides less effective. And if we make herbicides less effective, I think we're going to need to use tillage every once in a while. Now, I totally believe we have overused tillage severely in the past, and I don't want to see us going back to that kind of system. But I do think tactical tillage at the appropriate time and as little as possible can really help us with weed control and can actually help us sustain the length of time that that herbicides are effective in our system. So I don't tend to be strong one way or the other. I think there's a lot of benefits to no-till and direct seed, but I actually think the more sustainable route would involve a little bit of tillage here and there. And as a scientist and as growers, I think our responsibility is to try and figure out how we can use it for greatest weed control benefit and least degradation to our soil resource.
As far as I'm concerned, herbicide weed resistance is up there with soil pH problems as one of the most pressing issues facing Pacific Northwest wheat farmers. I don't know how long we can avoid the chickens coming home to roost, but if you listen to the rest of Lyon's interview, you certainly come away thinking there's not much time. Coming in at the 9th position is Episode 41, The Only Constant is Change, which was my visit with the director of the Northern Pacific Railroad Depot Museum in Ritzville. R.L. Kike was 81 when I interviewed him and still spry. Kike did a magnificent job of explaining the importance of the telegraph. As one of the few telegraphers remaining in the U.S., his story of the origin of the technology and how it leads in a straight line to our smartphone devices of today is a wonderful reminder of how the world changes. Here, Kike tells the story of the first demonstration of the telegraph in America.
And so it was first successfully demonstrated in May of 1844. They strung a wire between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. Now, there's a little history behind that. Most history books say that the first message was, "What hath God wrought?" Wrong. That is not. That is not. There's a little political history behind that. The president, John Tyler, was considered by today's standards ultra, ultra conservative. And Morse, on the other hand, by today's standards, would be considered a bleeding heart liberal. The president said, "You and your buddy, get out of here with that contraption. We've got the best Pony Express service and the finest mail system in the world. I'm not going to give you a penny for that," what he called, "futuristic voodoo nonsense." And he kept going back. And the president finally said, "If those two guys show up here at the White House, run them off." So they decided to try Congress. And a few congressmen reluctantly agreed to look at it, but they wouldn't promise any funding. So naturally, the day of the dedication and the demonstration, Morse gets on the wire in Washington and he taps out, "Tyler ought to be hung." So Vail taps back, "Hanging's too good for him." So the third message was, "Here comes those idiots from Congress." And so when they were all standing around, then finally they picked out a verse from the Heilige Schrift, the Holy Bible. "What hath God wrought?" And after all, that looks better in the history books than "Tyler ought to be hung."
I never could verify Kite's version of that first telegraph conversation, but I'm willing to believe he has some inside knowledge. Number 10 on my list is Episode 20, Wheat Monetization, Little by Little. I can't believe it was only a year ago last May that I was in Tanzania as part of a study trip to determine whether U.S. food aid wheat being shipped to the East African country and sold to benefit NGO activities there was a wise use of our commodity. Leonard Schock, a farmer from Montana, summed up what he thought of the trip using the poem of a young African girl as the stepping-off point for his own effort.
I'm reminded on that walk to the field of a Malawi little African or East African gal, and she had a poem. The title of her poem is "Little by Little." Little by little, we have educated ourselves. And this is not her poem, but summing up our week here. Little by little, we have educated ourselves. And little by little, maybe we have educated them. And little by little, we can raise everybody's lifestyles and standards of living, and little by little, the world will become better.
I'm pretty sure I've never run into a farmer who writes poetry, but Schock's poem crystallized for me how I would also like America to help raise the world's standard of living, and little by little, the world will become better. Here's my top 10 list again for those paying attention, beginning with Episode 16, Pay Attention, Episode 8, Low Soil pH, Episode 72, Spring Seeding with the WGC's Mike Carstensen. Episode 67, Lima Grain Shakes Things Up. Episode 53, Meet Derek Sanderson, Policy Wonk. Episode 40, Not Just Wheat Country Anymore. Episode 60, Here Today, Japan Tomorrow. Episode 46, The Challenge That Will Not Wait. Episode 41, The Only Constant Is Change. And Episode 20, Wheat Monetization, Little by Little. One last thing before I close Episode 75, or what I'm calling a few of my favorite podcasts. And that's to remind you again, if you're listening to this podcast on iTunes, please rate it. And please subscribe. We're forgetful, but if you have a subscription, your devices will automatically remind you of a new podcast episode. For the record, each podcast is released Tuesday morning. I hope you enjoyed Episode 75 and will join me again next time for another episode of Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.